From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. After almost a year of prognostication that Donald Trump could never, ever win the GOP nomination, well, you know. But now a funny thing is happening. Rather than shame, fear, or chagrin, the columnists and talking heads are feeling a frisson, titillation in the form of speculation.
As they say, desperate times call for desperate measures.
Voters in this country right now are rejecting a two-party system.
And we could have a third-party independent Republican candidacy this fall, I think.
But not just any third-party candidacy. As former Politico CEO Jim VandeHei wrote in an op-ed last month, the ideal candidate would be an innovator, someone who would embrace Silicon Valley and disrupt the establishment, someone like Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, or, as journalist Mike Allen said in 2012, someone who understands that we live in a time when
the American people want a sort of more muted politics, this more centrist politics.
Like who?
That's exactly where Michael Bloomberg is.
Or, as New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman noted in 2011, what we really need is someone who gets that
we need a shock to the system. The country, in my view, is in a radical mood.
Like who?
If Michael Bloomberg wants to run, I'm very happy to vote for him.
It basically seems to be a search for Michael Bloomberg or someone like him, recurring over and over and over.
Brendan Nyhan is a political scientist who teaches government at Dartmouth.
If you have a feeling like this is Groundhog Day, the movie, that's how it feels, at least to me, because pundits have been having the same fantasy about a third party centrist candidate winning by acclamation for most of my adult lifetime.
So when you say Michael Bloomberg-like, what are you talking about?
Socially moderate, economically moderate, a technocrat who's above petty partisan politics, who will solve problems that the squabbling partisans won't. What's so interesting about this pundit demand for a candidate like Bloomberg is that they are his base. They like his views far more than everyday Americans do. Even if Americans, on average, have a relatively moderate issue position, it doesn't mean that on every single issue they have a moderate issue position. As research in political science has shown, the people who come out as moderates actually look more like a kind of Ross Perot or Trump-like candidate. They might be hostile to free trade and hostile to immigration, for instance, which are positions that neither party embraced, at least until recently.
There was a recent op-ed in the Wall Street Journal along these lines that's generated a lot of attention and a certain amount of mockery. It's by the former CEO of Politico, Jim VandeHei. It was called Bring on a Third Party, which he dubbed the Innovation Party, led by the likes of, say, Mark Zuckerberg or Sheryl Sandberg, with Michael Bloomberg as Treasury Secretary. He said it would be basically driven by innovation and apps.
I'm trying to restrain my laughter.
He asserts that his proposal is derived from his experience of, quote, normal America. Is it what America wants?
No. One misunderstanding is that the fact that many Americans don't identify with one of the two major parties means they want a centrist. That's false. We're in an election cycle where the energy has been generated by Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. No one sits around thinking, boy, I wish Mark Zuckerberg could be president, or I want to support a party that's based on innovation.
What is it that these pundits see in American politics that makes them long for a third way?
We have a set of civic ideals that are based around the mid-20th century version of America, when we had a large group of centrist Southern Democrats who almost functioned as a kind of third party. There was much more room for compromise. The parties were much less ideologically distinct. But that's not how our political system works anymore. And the deep disagreement that our party's polarization reflects can't be easily solved. We have had independents elected as governors, for instance. Many of them have had a tough time because neither party is fully supportive of them. Right? Ask Jesse the Body Ventura, former governor of Minnesota, who had a terrible time facing Democrats and Republicans in the state legislature there. The third party fantasy highlights the tendency of the media to exaggerate unlikely prospects for the sake of generating controversial opinions. It also highlights just how vulnerable pundits are, as we all are, I think, to project our views onto everybody else, it's very revealing of how insular their perspective is that they think there's widespread demand for this kind of candidate when the polling is staring them in the face saying it's not true.
Brendan, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Brendan Nyhan is a political scientist and assistant professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. So, if the pundits assume that a winning third-party candidate should be and would be above partisan politics, above ideology, the New Republic's Brian Beutler says that's a profoundly misguided notion, one that stems from the media's reluctance to address fundamental political beliefs. Journalistic neutrality, so to speak, is easier to maintain when focused on process rather than principles. Thus, writes Beutler, ideological blinders are a key part of the industry's work attire.
So if you see conflict between President Obama on the one hand and House Speaker Paul Ryan on the other hand, and you can't trace the conflict that they have back to fights about the nature of the scope and scale of government and what government should do that go back decades, and you instead attribute it to their personal failures as leaders, then it's tempting to imagine that somebody from outside the system who has better leadership qualities can just heal what ails the political system.
So if it isn't just a political problem because the parties can't get along, but deep ideological problems, then these pundits that come up annually with these proposals, all of which look pretty much alike, they're not only irrelevant, but they're far more reflective of the weaknesses that are baked into the media business generally. Is that fair?
I think that's right. The reason the Bernie Sanders campaign and the Donald Trump campaign were successful is because they spoke to unmet needs among the voting public. And in fact, part of the reason why this kind of centrist idea has escaped politics or
failed.
Yeah, failed in politics is that politicians that had those beliefs weren't able to keep their jobs because the suite of ideas that they proposed and that they pursued in office weren't particularly popular.
So how do you think the third party enthusiasts reconcile the understanding that Sanders and Trump have tapped into something with their own conviction that we can discount what it is that they've tapped into?
My guess would be that on the one hand, they see that if candidates like Trump and Sanders prove that there are millions and millions of voters who feel disaffected by more conventional politics, that Sanders and Trump's appeal is in the rhetoric that they use about the system being corrupt and rigged against normal people, but that the solutions that both Sanders and Trump propose have nothing to do with why they're popular with their voters, and that if you could just take the different kinds of rhetorical flourish that both of those candidates use and apply them to a more, I guess you could call it, a more like beltway appropriate mix of policies, that the people who are responding to Sanders and Trump would respond just as well to beltway centrism.
You suggested that the media ought to start thinking about whether the professional malaise, neutrality dressed up as objectivity, is hindering it.
If we're getting this really silly species of journalism on a regular basis, and the reason is because people who have spent careers in journalism have so blinded themselves to the substantive underpinnings of political conflict that they can't understand why calling for this kind of third-party candidacy could never take hold and could never disrupt the system, they are not getting at the core of what's really causing the vitriol that we see every election cycle, because they're blind to the real forces driving those things and are concocting new ones to be able to tell a story that isn't biased.
And the most common one they concoct is?
That there's a leadership void in Washington, that all the country really needs is a leader of rare talent backed by ideologically neutral financiers, and we could solve all the nation's problems.
About 5 years ago, former CEO of Politico Jim VandeHei and his political colleague Mike Allen made an online poll asking, quote, readers on Politico, Yahoo, Facebook, and Twitter to nominate people in politics, business, or entertainment who could harness the public's hunger for something new and inspiring. Not a scientific poll, obviously.
Not scientific at all.
They were hoping, however, to see who, at least among this technological elite, would choose as their ideal candidate for innovative change. Do you remember who won that poll?
I believe it was none other than innovator, outsider Hillary Clinton.
Brian, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Brian Beutler is a senior editor at The New Republic and the host of Primary Concerns, a podcast about the 2016 presidential primaries. Even if the prospect of a third-party run is dim, the driving force behind the idea blazes bright. The sense that this election poses a threat to the party system as we know it, that this year could produce what eminent political scientist Walter Dean Burnham famously termed a critical election, leading to a political realignment and historic reshuffling. It happened after the 1932 election, when the Democratic Party created a majority base around African Americans, farmers, and Southern whites, and after 1968, when civil rights became a national issue, Southern whites gravitated toward the Republican Party. Burnham calls critical elections surrogates for revolution, when pressure from an unresponsive political establishment accumulates like gas from a faulty valve.
Then a triggering event occurs. It can be anything. Back in the 1850s, it was the passage of an act that opened up parts of the free West to slavery, for example. Mm-hmm. In the 1890s, it turned out to be the battle over silver versus gold in the currency. And in the 1930s, it had a lot to do with, of course, the great smash-up when unemployment was 25% in some places. And where I was, in Pittsburgh, it was 35%. That was real misery. And the Republicans always claimed they knew how to manage a modern economy, and that argument perished along with the stock market crash in 1929.
And 1968?
The triggering event were several-fold happening simultaneously. One of them is the civil rights movement, which already had begun to impose a second Reconstruction on the Jim Crow regime in the South. The other was, of course, the Vietnam War, which was intensely unpopular and got more and more so as you approach the end of Johnson's administration. And then the Democrats parachuted in Hubert Humphrey, who never entered any primaries, at the last minute to head off the insurgents under Gene McCarthy and, until he was assassinated, Bobby Kennedy. The establishment won out, but there was a riotous convention in Chicago.
Burnham says that what we seem to be undergoing now is part of a realignment. The country and its institutions are shifting in segments, a process that began with the transformation of economic policy in the Reagan administration, the first part of what he calls a realignment sequence. Now, after a slow build, come the triggering events caused by the deepening disconnect between the government and the governed, and caused not just by Reaganomics, but also bipartisan trade agreements, the outsourcing of factory jobs, and a lot more.
What that did was create a bifurcated society. The folks who were plugged into the high tech, who were plugged into adequate education, they're part of the blessed. The ones who wound up in high school, whose fathers and grandfathers used to be able to get nice jobs in manufacturing so they could actually run what they called a middle-class existence, these guys are part of the cursed. A triggering event with a longer time frame was the great crash of 2008-2010. That was the second worst crash of more than 100 years. While the banks got out scot-free, and while at the same time those at the very top were making out like bad nuts. This was a case in which elite malfeasance and nonfeasance played an extraordinarily important role. And that paved the way for, among other things, the abrupt emergence of the Tea Party in 2009, followed by the collapse of the Democrats in 2010 at all levels of election.
Is this realignment going on just within the GOP?
No, look at Sanders. He beat Hillary in Indiana, of all places, a socialist from the smallest state in the union, practically, who bangs away at the basic issues of economic malfeasance and nonfeasance affecting very large parts of the population. It's reflective of a fragmented political system which is in the grips of a basic crisis of identity and a basic crisis of legitimacy.
I leaned on Burnham for a historical analogy to today, and after some pressure, he came up with the election of 1854, spurred in part by the opening of vast tracts of the West to slavery. But not only that.
It was a case when one of the parties was destroyed absolutely, another was crippled, a third arose from absolutely nowhere, and it had nothing to do with the Republicans initially. It was the Know-Nothings. The Americans, the ones who really wanted to go on a hunt for Irish Catholics and were not interested in slavery, sectionalism, or anything else. It's where we had the largest influx of immigration proportionate to the size of the resident population we ever had. I mean, it's exactly where a lot of the support for the Tea Party came from in 2009. They are very, very committed to the notion that we need to take our country back again. From whom? I assume blacks. Other minorities. Take a look at the rise of Donald Trump. He's not only a master showman, but he's also a symptom. He entered into something that was a total vacuum. The establishment completely lost control of the situation and never regained it because polarization has reached heights never before seen in modern times. You've got to go back to somewhere around the Civil War era to find its parallel in roll call voting.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, and good luck.
Walter Dean Burnham is Professor Emeritus at the University of Texas at Austin. Sean Wilentz is the George Henry Davis 1886 Professor of American History at Princeton University. And he says that this is the year when a political cliché comes true. It may actually be the most important election of your lifetime.
The point is that we're at a crossroads, and the country's either going to become one thing or the other, and this has been building up for 40 years. The Republican Party is in control of most of the state houses. They have control of the House of Representatives, they have control of the Senate, and until Justice Scalia's demise, it was a very conservative court. So they were in control of everything except the White House. If a Republican does win the White House, one party will be in control of American government from stem to stern. If the Democrat wins, it's a reasonable likelihood that the Senate will fall back into Democratic hands. And with the Scalia vacancy, then the Supreme Court would look extraordinarily different than it would if a Republican were elected.
How would you situate this moment in the history of partisan politics?
Well, at one level, it's sui generis. The history of American politics has never seen a figure like Donald Trump before. But in other ways, I mean, American elections are never identical, but they sometimes rhyme with each other. Watching the television today, actually, and watching what's going on inside the Republican Party, it looks like something that happened more than a century ago. And that's when two political parties dissolved, first the Whigs and then the Democrats in 1854 and then in 1860.
That's what Walter Dean Burnham said.
Oh, well, maybe I am a political scientist. You know, the Whig Party split in two over the slavery issue, and they could not hold it together. I mean, with Republicans, including both Bush presidents and the last nominee, saying they will not go to the convention, we might be seeing, perhaps over the next year, something that would be truly extraordinary, which would be the dissolution of a major American political party.
You don't really think that's going to happen, do you?
It's not 1854. It's only rhyming.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not over slavery in quite the same way. What is the most solid base of the Republican Party today? It's the white male South. The strongest element in the base of the Democratic Party are African Americans. That sounds a lot like the Civil War to me. The Republican Party leadership, ever since Reagan, thought that they could, you know, hold together basically a billionaire class party by appealing to the racial and other social stuff and keep those people riled up and call on them every 2 years and certainly every 4 years to bring them back into power. That base got fed up. They weakened the party structure. It became a very cynical game.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no party there. It was bound to happen eventually. And they started going down that road because, in fact, there was nobody who could succeed Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was one of a kind. There was no conservative to replace him. So you started with George H.W. Bush, and you started with Gingrich coming up to challenge him, and then the dialectic began. But in effect, the old party was badly, badly weakened. there's no center to the Republican Party as a result. That is not unlike what happened in 1854.
Sean, thank you very much.
Brooke, it's been a delight as ever.
Sean Wilentz is the George Henry Davis 1886 Professor of American History at Princeton University.
Coming up, is Puerto Rico now paying the price of its bad behavior or the price of ours?
As an example of an underdeveloped land that is going through an industrial revolution without violence and without communism, Puerto Rico has been called a showcase of America.
This is On the Media.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, yet another shoe dropped in Puerto Rico's debt crisis.
Puerto Rico has defaulted on a $422 million bond payment that was due today. Its officials warned the U.S. territory's debt crisis could soon worsen without the help of Congress.
Today's missed payment is the biggest yet in a series of defaults by that island. Puerto Rico owes a staggering $72 billion.
Puerto Rico's governor says the government can't pay the bonds without cutting essential services. Nearly all of the bonds are held by U.S. hedge funds and mutual funds. Puerto Rico has been in a recession for 10 years.
Puerto Ricans are leaving the island at a record rate. New research shows that San Juan, the island's largest city, lost 40,000 people, or 10% of its population, since 2010. Among native Puerto Ricans, most said they left for job or family reasons.
Up until the 80s, Puerto Rico's municipalities could declare Chapter 9 bankruptcy and restructure their debt, like, say, Detroit. But due to an obscure and inexplicable loophole written in 1984, that's no longer an option. So the debt crisis is complicated, and a national ad campaign is further muddying the waters.
After years of wild overspending, Puerto Rico is out of money. Who will bail out Puerto Rico? Washington says you will. Congress wants to change the rules to grant Puerto Rico unprecedented bankruptcy protection called Super Chapter 9. Tell Congress, stop the Washington bailout of Puerto Rico.
The ad is made by a group called the Center for Individual Freedom, which is targeting members of Congress who seem open to allowing Puerto Rico to negotiate its debt. Watchdogs don't know who's behind the nearly $2 million ad buy, but HBO's John Oliver recently had a guess.
They are a dark money group, so it's impossible to say where that money came from. Hedge funds! Hedge funds gave them the money! It's impossible to say. Hedge funds! Impossible.
And the reference to Puerto Rico's years of, quote, wild overspending ignores the reality that its debt isn't entirely of its own making. The message that Puerto Rico should pull itself up by its own bootstraps ignores the fact that Congress has had control of those bootstraps for 118 years. Harry Frankie Rivera is a historian and researcher with the Center for Puerto Rican Studies at the City University of New York. Harry, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Apart from the factual errors in that ad suggesting that Puerto Rico somehow is in control of its own destiny, you actually see a different problem with the message it's trying to convey.
Yeah, it actually portrays Puerto Ricans as alien, as foreigners. It is ironic because Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. Almost 5 million Puerto Ricans who live in the United States pay all kinds of taxes. And Puerto Ricans on the island, they don't pay federal income tax, but they pay all kinds of taxes, including Medicaid, Medicare, for which they are not fully reimbursed.
And it isn't just this advertisement. This week, for example, there was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal titled, Puerto Rico's Debt Portent, the Refugee Exodus Builds, and Will Add to the U.S. Dole. Portraying them as kind of invaders from within, parasites on our economy and way of life, but they're citizens, and as you say, taxpayers. But the refugee assertion is turning out actually to be right, because many people are abandoning the island.
Well, you know, that article actually created a lot of talk among the Puerto Rican community. But this goes beyond opinion makers and the American public appreciation. This goes back to the way the United States decided to set up the political relationship between the United States and Puerto Rico and created this colonial framework in which Puerto Rico belonged to the United States, but it's not part of it. The message had always been, due to these plenary powers of Congress, that Puerto Ricans are incapable of governing themselves. And that was the case since 1901 to the present. But at the same time, they say they're incapable, but they should manage, which is something that is very contradictory.
You know, history is always good for context, but in this particular case, there is such a perfect storm that has converged, consisting of all these statutory quirks regarding Puerto Rico since it became a U.S. territory at the turn of the last century. We should review that history, otherwise there's no way to understand how we got to where we are today. So can we just go back to 1898 in the Spanish-American War?
Yeah, in 1898, as the United States intervened in the Cuban War of Independence, even before Puerto Rico was invaded, it had been decided that it was going to become part of the United States in lieu of indemnities. If Spain would not pay indemnities, Puerto Rico would be that payment. The military considered Puerto Rico to be really important to defend the Caribbean and the projected Panama Canal, which was really important for projecting American power. So Puerto Rico was not going to be free. What happened afterwards is that a military government is established, and it lasted for almost 2 years. Finally, in 1900, we had the Foraker Act that creates the first civil government, but which still reported to military authorities. Puerto Rico is going to be under the Department of War until the 1930s, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt passed Puerto Rico to the Department of the Interior. So you could say that Puerto Rico went from being a Spanish military colony to an American military colony.
And was treated as a thing apart from the beginning. A Supreme Court case determined that Puerto Rico was, quote, foreign in a domestic sense, whatever in the world that was supposed to mean. But clearly it was supposed to mean that it's a special case.
Yes, because the United States didn't know what to do with it. Puerto Rico was not to be annexed. One of the main reasons supported by historians of Puerto Rico is that the United States was abhorred by the racial composition and the culture in Puerto Rico, which was mostly dominated by Spanish-speaking Catholic people. And that didn't sit well, but the island was necessary. So what to do? Let's create a different category to put Puerto Rico on. That's the unincorporated territory.
And used Puerto Rico as kind of a plaything to advance the United States' economic interests, its military interests, and political interests. One such piece of legislation was the Merchant Marine Act, which says that all goods in Puerto Rico must be exported from the United States. And what was the impact on Puerto Ricans?
Well, what it did is that it made imports and exports about 20 to 25% more expensive. So you can imagine what it will do to an island in which, when the United States got there, it's an agrarian society. People don't earn that much, and all of a sudden, everything becomes more expensive, and it continues to this day. Some experts have said that if there was an exception and Puerto Rico did not had to operate under that clause, well, first of all, commodities will be way cheaper, and they may create between 30,000 to 50,000 jobs, which Puerto Rico desperately needs.
At one point, the federal government decided to stimulate the economy by creating tax breaks for corporations who wanted to build factories there. And it worked really, really well, or at least so it seemed.
Well, this happened in the 1970s when the Section 936 of the U.S. Internal Revenue Code was designed specifically to attract mainland investors to Puerto Rico. Companies received as much as $70,000 a year in tax write-off for each job created under Section 936. So you can see how attractive this is. It kind of worked because it did stimulate the economy. It created jobs, most of which were full-time and much better paid than what the average Puerto Rican could get anywhere. But these sections were created in the 1970s because of the Cold War. We continued to try to make Cuba fail. And on the other hand, Puerto Rico was portrayed as the Pearl of the Caribbean. What would happen to your country if you align with the United States, with the West. So Puerto Rico could not fail.
As an example of an underdeveloped land that is going through an industrial revolution without violence and without communism, Puerto Rico has been called a showcase of America. The growth of industry, agriculture, and the tourist trade is raising the standard of living.
So the infusion of jobs into Puerto Rico was a kind of propaganda move to create a kind of Potemkin village to show the world, especially Cubans, what happens if you're aligned with the United States as opposed to being aligned with the Soviet Union.
Exactly. We're going to help Puerto Rico, but there's going to be something in return for the corporations and for our foreign policy as well.
So then two bad things happened to Puerto Rico. First, the Cold War ended, and then the economic blowout of 2008. What happened to manufacturing jobs?
The 936 started to phase out. Puerto Rico started to lose manufacturing jobs. First, a few hundred, then thousands a year. Finally, tens of thousands of jobs were lost. And finally, by 2006, Puerto Rico is in a deep economic crisis, even before the United States gets into its recession, which has always been the case. Puerto Rico gets into a recession of its own before the mainland gets into it.
But before we portray Puerto Rico only as a victim of the machinations of the mainland, it's not entirely blameless in this.
Yes, definitely there's been mismanagement, waste, corruption, and many bad decisions. Up to the end of the 1990s, Puerto Rico had been really good at paying its bonds. So when 936 started to be phased out, the government decided to borrow heavily to engage in public works and even in a universal healthcare system, thinking that somehow that would spark the economy. And the problem wasn't apparent at first because there was a large tax base, as most of the 936 companies were still there. But as they started to move away and unemployment rose, that combined with the borrowing, and that's how we got to this debt.
And here we get to a pretty significant irony. We were talking before about comparing Puerto Rico to Cuba in the grasp of the evil empire. Now, Puerto Rico is in a free fall, and Cuba is in its ascendancy. We're restoring relations incrementally with the still communist island. It's enjoying the attention of the U.S. government and the goodwill, while our former poster child for capitalism is in a death spiral.
Cuba has always been more sexy than Puerto Rico. And this opening of Cuba is going to affect Puerto Rican tourism. It's also going to affect American investment. And Puerto Rico, in the shape it is, even though it has an impressive infrastructure, it's going to be hard for Puerto Rico to compete with Cuba. And as a matter of fact, if you add to that the Zika virus, recently people are canceling their hotel reservations because it was announced that hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans may be infected with the Zika virus by the end of the year. So there's going to be hard times for Puerto Rico.
So Congress had the opportunity to restore bankruptcy protection to the island, left town for a brief recess without acting. What is likely to happen next?
I think that Congress is going to continue to move slowly. I don't think that the Puerto Rican crisis is in the radar of many Congress people. Not even the Speaker of the House, Ryan, can get a consensus for the plan he presented, which fails to address many of the issues with Puerto Rico's economy. And it actually installed an oversight board, which has been received with mixed feelings in Puerto Rico. It's seen as colonialism, but a sector of Puerto Ricans would have it just to get something done.
But there is one thing the island has going for it, and that's Lin-Manuel Miranda, the creator and star of the Broadway show Hamilton, whose family is from Puerto Rico, and he is the public face of the crisis. He sang this on John Oliver's show.
Paul Ryan, I'll come sing Hamilton at your house. I'll do-si-do with Pelosi. I'll wear my Hamilton blouse. Your citizens are suffering. Stop the bleeding. Stop the loss. Help Puerto Rico. It's just 100 miles across. Thank you.
Is that going to help?
I think it might help. Even Speaker Ryan started to talk more about Puerto Rico.
I was just getting ready to watch Game of Thrones, which was the season premiere.
Yes.
So I turned it on early, and that was on. That guy came on the stage and starts throwing my name around. That was very surreal.
I want you to focus on Puerto Rico.
Yeah, so we are focused on Puerto Rico.
The diaspora, I really organized it and putting their foot forward for Puerto Rico to reach out to Congress to make sure that people know about this and what is going on. But this crisis and the reluctance of Congress to deal with it has united Puerto Ricans in the island and with Puerto Ricans in the diaspora in a way that in my 44 years of life I never seen before. So I think this is a really positive effect of the recession and of Congress' reluctance to address it.
Kind of like a family crisis can heal a poor marriage.
Exactly, like a family crisis. And the numbers do show that Puerto Ricans are moving to key states, Florida, but also in Virginia and in Ohio. They're in states that are really crucial to decide the election. Puerto Ricans are going to be vital to deciding who is the president of the United States.
What if we just build a wall?
Well, I guess the wall will come down, then it's going to be used to flow to Florida. I mean,
Harry, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Harry Franqui Rivera is a historian and researcher with the Center for Puerto Rican Studies at the City University of New York.
Coming up, nearly four decades after the Iranian Revolution, you can be on the streets of 70s Tehran and influence the action inside a game.
Why'd you throw the rock, Reza? What are you, a freedom fighter now?
I lost myself.
You're here to observe and document, okay?
This is On the Media.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A new video game, 1979 Revolution Black Friday, projects the player into an uprising widely covered and often distorted by the media. The Iranian Revolution that ousted the corrupt U.S.-backed Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi and installed the repressive Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. The game covers the 2 days leading up to and including September 8, 1978, Black Friday, when hundreds of Iranian protesters were gunned down by government soldiers. We see all this through the lens of the main character, an aspiring Iranian photojournalist named Reza Shirazi, just back in Tehran from studying abroad. You can choose the actions he takes, whether to say, take a picture or pick up a rock. The fates of his friends may hinge on your decisions.
Don't do this, Reza. Trust me. You throw that rock and it's gonna change you.
You can do this. Make a stand.
Just drop it, Reza.
As Reza, you walk the streets. You pass car radios airing news reports in Farsi or English. Your choice.
The Iranian government says that the death toll from the terrorist attack on Cinema Rex and Abadan has officially reached 400.
The young photojournalist Reza is loosely based on the life of the game maker himself, Iranian-Canadian Navid Kansari.
My grandfather took me out to the streets. I was an extremely curious child and always looking out the window of our third-floor apartment. And finally, he said, okay, let's go. While I didn't understand what was taking place, I think, you know, something that really resonated with me was listening to the concern in my mom's voice when I was standing by a window and if soldiers were shooting up in the air and her concern about a bullet coming through the window and just saying, get down. The idea of get down was just something I'd seen in movies and now was playing in my living room.
The person that we are essentially playing in the game is in a tug of war between the urge to document the revolution and a kind of longing to join in. Is that a tension that you struggled with?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a tension that most of us struggle with. We don't represent the far right. We don't represent the far left. We're kind of stuck in the middle. And on certain decisions, we waver between one side to the other.
Reza! Reza, over here!
Oh,
you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Where's Addy?
I lost him.
Why'd you throw the rock, Reza? What are you, a freedom fighter now?
I lost myself.
You're here to observe and document, okay? Take your pictures now before they tear gas the place. Show the world what's going on in our streets.
I didn't want to make just a game. I wanted to create a world that allows the player to actually control and write their own narrative. And I think by putting people in directly those shoes, by putting them on the streets of Tehran, it's much easier to dispel what we've seen over the past 35 years of how Iran has been portrayed, because it's not just about clerics and it's just not about women covered up in veils. This revolution was termed the Islamic Revolution only after the revolution took place. But if you take a look at all the people that were involved in it, Islam and its representation was a fraction, was a part of it.
Could you describe a crucial choice that you as a player can make that has a fateful impact on something in the game?
When you are in the protest and you come across your cousin Ali, and Ali's a member of the Mujahideen, he is the Che Guevara of our story, charismatic, a rebel, but also has gone down a dark path by embracing violence. Your closest friend, Babak, who also happens to be from a totally different social class, is on the other side.
They're taking Abbas. Final chance to redeem yourself. Do it.
Don't listen to him, Reza. It's not the only way.
I'll stick to taking pictures.
You disappoint me, Reza.
That's a decisive moment?
Yeah. Are you in or are you out? When he doesn't pick up the rock, he goes to his place of strength, which is documenting what takes place. But when he throws the rock, then what it does is ensues others around him to start throwing rocks. And the situation eventually leads towards a riot.
This game is really graphic at times. We scrub blood from the body of a stabbing victim. We are threatened with torture by an interrogator more than once. You felt you had to show that.
Absolutely. I mean, look, that character that you're being interrogated by is named Asadullah Lajavardi, the actual interrogator in Evin prison after the revolution.
No. What is my name?
I don't care who you are.
Reza. Why can't you show me the decency of remembering my name?
We want to create a real experience. We need to understand how they were interrogating people and the tough choices that you make. Because in an interrogation, you choose between bad and worse. And we wanted to make sure that that would draw you into this experience.
You released the game earlier this month, about a week or so later. The Tehran Times reported that Iran's National Foundation for Computer Games banned your game because it, quote, could poison the minds of the youth and damage their spirit. Was it a surprise that the Iranian government agency banned your game?
I was surprised at their reasoning. Usually they just say that this is no longer available because it's American propaganda. But all they've really done is actually gotten more and more people within Iran excited to play the game. The torrent sites are, you know, off the hook right now. People are ripping the game.
Now, let us stipulate here, because the listeners don't know, we haven't mentioned it yet. You helped produce a lot of the violent Grand Theft Auto games. I mean, you've been in the blast of controversy for extreme violence in those games for a long time. But how does this violence compare or contrast with how you used it in Grand Theft Auto?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the violence that you have in Grand Theft Auto is there as a direction that you could take, and that's based on how you want to play it. And I guess you would say it's based on your own morality or how entertained you want to be. When I was in Iran, for example, I was in a small town and I came across a group of young kids who had actually lined up to talk to me.
When was this?
This was 2006. I was having breakfast, and there's a lineup of maybe like 20 kids from the village, and they had all played Grand Theft Auto. And they'd seen my name in the opening titles. I'm the only Iranian. So they're like, hey, can we chat with you? Can you sign this for us? And almost none of them spoke about the violence. Most of them spoke about getting in a car, driving around, the endless radio stations they could listen to. They can go to the gym and work out. Then they could go to a takeout place and eat as much as they can and then go and buy clothes. And that was the majority of what the conversation was about. And one girl, I remember she said, America must be a pretty amazing place if you could do that. And for me, it totally changed my perception. And I think that was the first time that I actually started thinking about the impact games can have across so many different ways.
In what way do you think the game most profoundly challenges the predominant Western media narratives of Iran?
Like anyone who's working within any kind of medium that's trying to reflect life, you want to be authentic. This is not a part of the world that's often covered. So we want corner stores, markets, the bakery, these elements that reflect Iranian day-to-day living. What you're experiencing, the streets that you're walking through, the people that you're seeing in their 70s garbs, the conversation that revolves around pop culture, the subtext of everything was no different anywhere around the world at that time.
Yeah, man. I've told her about you and your legendary disco moves. John Travolta, Bobo has nothing on me.
Nice.
When I arrived in Canada, it was during the U.S. hostage crisis. There was an aggressive tone in the air. It was a few days before Christmas, the first Christmas that the hostages weren't going to be back home. And I think I was able to break down the stereotypes that people have by using the exact same tools that I'm using in this game. I could relate to everybody when we talked about Star Wars, when we talked about games, when we talked about books. As we started connecting, all of those stereotypes slowly melted away because people just got to understand that we actually have something in common.
Near the end of the game, we're in Reza's parents' house the night before Black Friday, and he comes across their photographs, letters, and some videos. They all harken back to a more peaceful time.
I'm supposed to be looking for the camera, but I gotta check out Bobo's home movies. I have to take this back and show my buddies in Germany. They didn't believe me when I said we had beaches in Iran. Wait till they see this. Oh, please don't tell me this is where I... Yup, that's my first day of school.
Where did this footage come from? What are we seeing in these videos?
Well, that footage is actually footage my grandfather shot in Iran on Super 8. That first one with the Caspian Sea is actually my mom in a bathing suit at the Caspian Sea. And that first day of school is me going to school in Iran. My grandfather had been documenting from when my mom was a little girl.
Wow.
All the way to seeing her kind of grow up, all the different weddings that took place, the big rituals around the religious holidays where you would be making huge, huge meals and taking the offerings to those who were, you know, not as fortunate as you. I mean, this goes from the 50s. So for me, it's one of the ways that I can kind of connect to an Iran that I knew and a culture that I still celebrate. And I think that was important to kind of get in there. But I also thought when I was looking at these and I showed it to people who didn't know anything about me, they were like, that looks just like my home movies from the 70s. You know, it was incredible in that way. And that made me think, wow, it's a tool now that I've used consistently because I really do believe at the core of all of us that there's this ability to be able to connect if we just break down all these illusions that we're so different from one another.
Navid, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Navid Kansari is the creator of 1979 Revolution Black Friday. Next month, you'll be able to find it on your smartphone.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Dasha Lizitsina. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Casey Holford and Casey Means. This week, we'll have to say goodbye to our beloved associate producer, Kimmy Regler. We'll miss her excessive and never-waning good cheer, her mantra, "It'll be great," and her always replenished bowl of almonds. We will really miss those almonds.
Thanks, Kimmy, for Shakespeare, nihilism, counter-narratives, for flibanserin, the story, not the drug, and for being you. Here's to the unbreakable Kimmy Regler. Katja Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.